When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
We have a special bonus episode of Solving JFK today. I'm going to be joined by Rob Clark and Joe Borelli from The Lone Gunman. Stay tuned for a special episode with Rob and Joe coming up next on Solving JFK.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
I don't know what this is all about.
Dallas police this morning resumed questioning the man they have formally charged with the assassination of President Kennedy.
I'm just a patsy.
The man is Lee Oswald.
Was Oswald acting alone, or was he a member of a conspiracy? Commission answers, he acted alone.
Rob, Joe, welcome to Solving JFK. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Matt.
Yes, sir. And Rob, you're the one who started this show, The Lone Gunman. And what year did you start the podcast then?
11 years ago in 2014.
11 years ago, yeah. Early to the game, and you're we were talking a little bit before we started recording here. The Lone Gunman was the first JFK podcast I listened to, and you know, I was like, dang, that was when one of the many times that I had the realization that I don't know anything, just how deep it is. I'm like, you don't understand, the magic bullet's not possible. It's like, hang on, dude, just please go sit over there, let's talk about it. So, but yeah, just props to you for sticking with it. And how many episodes now? 331?
We just did 331. And I also do another podcast with my friend Doug Campbell. It's called Quick Hits. And we just did episode 61 of that. We've been doing that for 6 years together. And yeah, man, it's been a long ride.
Right on. And you guys go live, right? Is that typically the format of your show?
Yeah, we just started. Well, the show has been purely auditory, you know, RSS feed, purely podcast style for like the first 10 years. And I got to a point where I was getting, I don't want to say bored with talking to myself for 10 years. But I just figured it was time for a change. And, you know, there's been a big thing. And it was about the 10th year that my YouTube channel finally hit 1,000 followers, right? I've been uploading auditory stuff for 10 years. So I was finally able to monetize the show. And I was thinking, okay, well, if I want to move this thing forward, it would be cool to do it on YouTube, on video. But I didn't want to do it by myself. So I reached out to Joe. We've been working on some things. He was just a listener before any of this. Yeah. And, started researching some things that we're going to be talking about here tonight and found some really cool stuff. And, you know, that inspired me to ask him to hop aboard the Lone Gunman train. And like I said, a year and what, 3 or 4 months later, here we are.
Yeah. Yeah. Every week. And it hasn't been easy, but it's been a really fun ride. We've got a ton of new followers. We have a really cool community, and we try to just, you know, do some document-based research, but have some fun with it. Like, we do some skits. Rob has a ton of great accents.
Amazing.
and yeah, I mean, it's been great so far. So
didn't want it to be like one of these old fuddy-duddy, because a lot of these JFK researchers are old dudes who are set in their ways. You know, they wear their little suit jackets with their, you know, the felt elbows, and they're very studious, very serious people. And I was like, you know, that's just not my style. You know, I'm just the opposite of that. So I'm very much stream of consciousness. I don't script out any of the shows at all. It's purely off the top of my head. Here we go. Let's do it.
Mm-hmm. And you guys, your perspective overall is you're on the belief that, you know, there's more than just what the Warren Report says that meets the eye, or what side of the coin do you guys fall on?
Is the title of the podcast throwing you a little bit? I still get this question. I'm like, it's meant to be ironic.
I just want to make sure listeners know.
Yeah, it's meant to be an ironic title. Okay, The Lone Gunman. And I named it that because I was doing it by myself, right? Not that I believe in a lone gunman, quite the opposite. And, you know, I'm definitely conspiracy oriented. That's where I come from. I'm just mentally, that's my orientation, you know, and I've always been a fan of digging, reading, researching. And, you know, I've solved this case 20 times in the past 30 years. You know?
Sure.
But, you know, the more you look into things, you know, and if you're honest with yourself and you find new things that don't support your theory, then you got to move on, mm-hmm. you know, and sometimes you can circle back once the new information pops up. But the more you dig, the more you find out, you know, it can shatter your reality of your perception of what you think happened or who you think was involved or who you think was behind it. And you just have to move on and swallow your pride. And a lot of researchers are not able to do that. So,
yeah. You guys, one thing that I noticed immediately when I was listening to you is that you're not just repeating everything that you heard on The Men Who Killed Kennedy. You have your own perspective on each individual, you know, controversy within the JFK conspiracy world. Because there's the arguing with, you know, Gerald Posner and Fred, our mutual friend Fred Litwin.
Yes, good guy. Yeah.
Arguing with those guys is one thing, but it's another thing, even people who agree that it wasn't Oswald alone, or maybe even that Oswald didn't fire shots, there's still so many disputed issues sort of inside the tent, you know?
Yeah, that's for sure. And I've never shied away from having lone nutters on my show, at least the ones that I think that I can have a conversation with. You know, even these crazy conspiracy theorists, I try not to have on the show, because I look at it like a credibility thing. If, you know, if you're able to have a civil, honest conversation, then great, you know, mm-hmm. but if you come at me with some crazy, kooky, off the wall theory that's been debunked 30 years ago, I'm not even going to touch it, you know, but, right. And I've had probably, I don't know, 10 or 12 different lone nutters on the show that I've been able to bring on, not really have a debate, but just have an honest conversation and kind of go back and forth and kick it back and forth. And it's been great so far. People don't like it when I do it, but I don't care. You know, I think it's interesting to be challenged on your points sometimes.
Oh, for sure.
It keeps you honest, you know?
Definitely.
And sharp. Yeah.
And, so I met Joe in Dallas this past November at one of the JFK conferences. And when we met, Joe, you were telling me about this original research that you've done that was kind of a big deal, the bottom line results of it. And actually there's a couple of things that you guys have brought to light. And it was all kind of around initially, correct me if I'm wrong, but your interest in the general idea that there's so many people in the case whose first name starts with a J and last name is Martin. Then you guys did a deep dive on them. And, okay. Coincidence that they're the same name, but some of those people actually had some real interesting stuff going on in the documents. Things that I had no idea about at all. And I'm 99% of the people listening to and watching this don't know about.
It was a random idea because there was a bunch of Martins that I noticed coming up in the assassination, whether that's Jack Martin. And of course, that wasn't his real name. It was Edward Suggs, but he had like three or four different Martin aliases. And I think we have like 30, about 30 J Martins that come up in the JFK.
37.
Yes. Some are a little like, you know, like on the edge there, but there's a lot of Martins that like not a lot of people looked into. And James Herbert Martin, who we consider the babysitter after the assassination, right? Like a babysitter that is not talked about. It's not a household name in the community. And we found some really good things. So what turned out, and we found a bunch of people that had J. Martin aliases, from Watergate burglars. It was crazy, but it ended up being a detailed study on a couple Martins. And of course, I think one of the best of research projects is ones where you have a hypothesis and you don't know where it's going to go, and you don't really have a vested interest in where it's going to go, but you see where it takes you. And that's kind of where we went. And
more to Joe's point, like when he says, you know, everybody thinks when you're talking about Oswald or Marina's Babysitters, you're thinking George Nemorin Shield, Ruth Payne, right? And this guy, James Herbert Martin, okay, you hear about him becoming Marina's business manager and her moving in with him after the assassination, but you don't really think of him as a babysitter. And we found some really, really interesting things about him and his wife that is going to blow your mind tonight, Matt, for real.
And okay. I'm excited. I'm excited to hear it. Hey, let me ask you this just from the outset. How did James H. Martin connect with Marina? So I know he was, I don't know if you guys are going to get into the whole, you know, he worked at Six Flags and all that, but I just, how could they even come across one another? What was that, the genesis of their relationship?
Well, as we get into the story a little bit, we think that he may have been attached somewhat to the Oswalds way before November 22nd, 1963.
Okay.
But when the opportunity presented itself for him to kind of get himself close to Marina and the kids, what we found out through the course of our investigation, and a lot of it has been bandied about before, but it seems to be, we came across a document where James Herbert Martin, you know, it kind of makes it seem like the Secret Service had a lot to do with putting her there, right? But as it turns out, James Herbert Martin had reached out to a sheriff in Fort Worth. And through this sheriff in Fort Worth, he had contacts with the Secret Service. And he said, look, I've got a really secluded place. Nobody, you know, it's like a ghost town around here. Nobody ever suspects she's here. Why don't you broach it with the Secret Service and see if, you know, if you want to bring her here. So he reached out to the Secret Service and offered up Six Flags motel to the Secret Service and Marina originally.
Yeah, as a discreet location to keep them temporarily.
Wow, so he reached out affirmatively, and then the Secret Service said, yes, random guy who's a manager of a motel, we're going to put them with you, random guy.
Cool. Exactly. They went and checked it out. You know, they did go and check it out, and sure enough, it was off-season type of thing. You know, there was nobody really around, and they really didn't have much better option keeping her in the Adolphus. Was not going well because the press was trying to get to him, and of course you had just random people, so they had to do something with her, and that seemed like the best option. And at the time, Marina did not want anything to do with the FBI. She didn't trust them at all. She didn't want to be in their custody at all. So it was up to the Secret Service to take her to the Six Flags, watch her for a little while till the funeral, and after Lee Harvey Oswald's funeral blew over. And then Martin made another offer right after Thanksgiving. I think it was November, 28th?
29th? 30th? Yeah. About 5 days after. Yeah.
He offered her to and her family to come and have Thanksgiving dinner with him and his family. He had his wife and three kids. And so she did. And then while they were having this dinner, he offered her and her kids to come stay with him. And that's where he would. And Marina didn't really have much options at this point. The Secret Service couldn't watch her forever. So they figured, you know, what the hell, let her go if that's what she wants to do. And then of course that morphed into him helping her out with her finances, becoming her business manager and taking advantage of her in more ways than one.
Yeah. And just for the timeline, Matt, so Oswald was obviously shot and killed on November 24th. That's when they moved Marina, the kids, Marguerite, and Robert into the Six Flags Motel. And I believe the, I misspoke there, the Thanksgiving dinner was on the 26th, maybe, like that Monday or Tuesday, like in the middle of the week, and they moved in to the Martin home, just Marina and her kids, at the end of November. So less than a week before, as they moved in to the Six Flags. And there's a bunch of documents. You know, the Secret Service had hours long taped interviews with Marina that have never come to light. And how did this random guy, like you said, just kind of finagle his way into hosting one of the most notorious families at the time? Definitely a week or two after.
Yeah, so we were digging and digging, right? And came across something very interesting. So when the Oswalds were leaving Russia, okay, they kind of took a train, you know, through Europe to Amsterdam, where they hopped on the SS Mazdam. And from there, they made their way to New York City. And this was in late May, early June of 62. Okay. So there's a website out there that actually has the manifest, okay, for who was on the SS Mazdam. So, you know, we're looking through there, and the Oswalds, they're on there. And lo and behold, a couple pages later, guess what else is on there?
J. Martin.
J. H. Martin.
Ooh, the H. Okay.
And it just happens to be with what, Joe, a wife and three kids, which matches what he had. Okay. And at this time, we don't really have a good idea of where exactly he was in his working life. I mean, we have a rough idea. He was basically working for the very first credit card company ever. It's called Carte Blanche. And it was given out by Hilton Hotels. Okay. And he was a salesman for this credit card. Okay. So he could have been anywhere in the world, basically, for his job. Right. The interesting thing is, he is, well, I can't say definitively this is him and his family, but it's just odd, okay, that you have this on the manifest, right? But that's not all. There's a picture, right, I found of the cruise, you know, the ship of when Oswald was on it. It has pictures of Oswald eating dinner or eating lunch. And it has pictures of different passengers on the thing. And there is a picture of a guy on the deck in a suit and sunglasses that looks a whole lot like James Herbert Martin.
Where are these pictures from?
They are from this. It's like some kind of classic website about the SS Mazdam.
Huh.
It's the weirdest thing ever. It's like a really obscure site. And it's different people that were on the ship. They submit their pictures. Now, I'm not a big fan of photographic evidence, if you will. But if this is him on the left, okay, these pictures would have been taken 2 years apart, because the one on the right is him accompanying Marina in 1964 to the Warren Commission hearings. This picture on the left would have been from 1962. I mean, it's, you know, there's nothing that says this is not him. You know, the chin looks relatively similar. The nose is similar. The lips are similar. The ears similar. The hairstyle, the haircut, similar. It seems he has a little more hair on the left, or maybe he combed it different. I don't know. But it's interesting. You know, it's interesting.
Yeah. So you've got that one, which it's you got J.H. Martin and the same number of family members. And that one's that's a pretty good one. But then there's another one, right? That's like the kind of this almost a smoking gun. The plot continues to thicken with James H. Martin.
Yeah. So fast forward a little bit, and after Marina moved in with him, okay, the DPD, Dallas Police, set up surveillance. Okay. Now, what's interesting is we found out a couple of things from these intelligence reports. There's a copies on Mary Farrell, right? And then there's also like the Portal to Texas History that has all the legit DPD files. Over there, we found a copy of a surveillance report. And at the bottom, it had handwriting that wasn't on the one at Mary Farrell. And it was handwritten in there, Joe. What did it say exactly?
Direct line to White House communications number 25. I believe I sent that to you. I could bring it up, Matt, if you don't have it.
Oh yeah. Straight line. Straight line installed 3 December '63, White House communications, Washington, D.C. Yeah. So, somebody wrote that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they wrote that, I believe the initial memo is on December 2nd. Where they're kind of giving background on James Herbert Martin and his wife. And ironically, that's the only time that James Herbert Martin's wife, Wanda Martin, was referred to by name. From here on out, it's Miss James H. Martin or Mrs. Martin. And, but you know, we think that maybe one of the conditions, okay, we could let Marina move in with you, but if anything comes up, you know, we're installing this line, you better pick up the phone ASAP. And as we get into the next document, the die circuit one, but that might make a little more sense. But that was a day after the inscription was the day after the document, and about 2 or 3 days after they moved in. So it was almost certainly a direct federal lease line circuit. And it's really interesting to think about, why did you have Marina under Secret Service surveillance? Why would you need to have a direct line to the White House, which is kind of circumventing the Secret Service in a sense? And that makes you really think, what was James Herbert Martin? Who was he really working for? And all this interagency rivalry going on then between the Secret Service and the CIA, FBI.
Because the line it says White House communications. So who would James Herbert Martin's wife be calling at the White House?
Well, it doesn't go directly to the White House. There's actually a building. There was actually back then a building in D.C. It was just called White House Communication, and was separate than the White House.
I see. 25, Building 25. Yeah,
Building 25, which we don't know what that means. But
well, Rob, it has a bunch of different agencies working in there, like a big federal bureaucracy. Like you have the CIA, you have the NSA, like you have a bunch of people in headquarters in that building.
It's like an information collection. Kind of agency where they're, you know, they have direct lines to the FBI, CIA, you know, DOD, DIA, all these different agencies, NSA, you know, back then. So we're not really sure, you know, why this line was installed or who installed it or who it was going to. We know it wasn't the FBI. We know it wasn't the Dallas Police. We know it wasn't the Secret Service. The list gets narrower and narrower, and we're going to narrow it down even a little bit more here in a little bit. Also interesting is that the Martins had an unlisted phone number installed in their house, along with a listed phone number, along with this direct line, because James Herbert Martin called his unlisted number from when he was in Washington, D.C. with Marina when they went to the Warren Commission hearings. And we were like, where's this other number? And then, you know, we found out it was their unlisted number at the Martin residence. So what is a hotel manager doing living in a house with a listed number and an unlisted number?
Right.
It's odd.
It's weird.
Yeah.
Okay. So, but this letter, so the bottom line implication of the letter from the Dallas police is that she is an informant of, so T1, but she's an informant on behalf of the police. Is that what that T1 means, coming from the police?
It's the informant is actually somebody that used to work with James Martin at the, when he was working at the Hilton there in Dallas.
This document talks about James Martin's employment background at the Statler right. Hilton. Yeah. Hey, there's the Statler Hilton again. That thing keeps popping up. Yeah. And, but really the most interesting thing is the handwriting at the bottom. Is that what you would say?
Yeah, because there is a copy, like I said, of Mary Farrell that does not have that. And then there's this one that was down at the other, the portal of the Texas History, which has it. I mean, it seems to me like it's something that, I mean, if it's a DPD document, somebody at the DPD would have had to write that on there.
Right.
You know, yeah. They probably, because they were surveilling the house, so they would have noticed something like that going on.
You know, as Rob and I in, I guess it was summer of 2023, huh? We were going through some of the new release documents when there were still some release documents. I think the last time was in 23, in like April or May. And we found a document that was less redacted than the previous version of Mrs. James H. Martin that was under oral contract by the CIA in 1964, which was when Marina was living with Wanda and James Herbert Martin. And we were kind of floored by this here.
But it wasn't at the same time that Marina was living with them. It was summer of 64 is when this document is from, right, Joe?
Yeah, it was an extension of an oral contract in June of 64, which yeah. implies that there was already an oral contract before that.
And what entity is this with?
CIA.
This is CIA?
This is a CIA document, yeah.
CIA.
Yep.
So there's a CIA document that says that James H. Martin's wife was under oral contract with the Central Intelligence Agency.
Yes.
Yes, sir. It says engagement of spouse of blank, redacted as redacted. The subject individual has been engaged under oral contract for use on the Project Die Circuit. The effective date of the oral contract is June 15, 64, and shall continue thereafter until termination. $50 a month. Subject is not a foreign national. And the interesting part about this is it's from the chief of base Berlin station, right? Which I'm guessing is West Berlin. And it's to the chief finance division. And they're trying to get a letter of recommendation for Miss James Herbert Martin to continue her oral contract here. And from what we can glean, it says, not your typical wife. Can't read that. Yeah. Anyways, it says,
Frank explained that the situation and the use of the woman had been previous reviewed and agreed to in the division. She is completely, and we don't know what that word is.
Divorced.
Divorced from the station by herself. As a wire intercept, I think you could build a case either way. Removing the case from the everyday contract wife would lead me to lean toward the status in this instance, and then it's signed by R.
And we know the CIA has worked with husband and wife teams. Look no further than Boris and Anna Tarasoff in Mexico. There are other examples as well. This is interesting because it blatantly tells you what she was doing, which is wire intercept work, which is basically intercepting phone calls and monitoring, you know, ingoing or outgoing phone calls to specific numbers. And it doesn't actually have to be, you know, in Berlin. She could do this from anywhere. But it's, yeah, it's just interesting, you know, like, okay. So
you're saying she was not just keeping an eye on Marina, but she was actually maybe had like a workstation and she was monitoring international calls potentially.
Yeah. I mean, that's what a wire intercepts do, right? They monitor phone transmissions and report back. You know, they might have to translate some things and report anything interesting that they hear. And like I said, if they were in Europe, okay, at the same time the Oswalds were in Russia, doing the same kind of thing under his cover as a Hilton carte blanche salesman, okay, of course he's going to be with around really big deals, really important business people, people with a lot of money, people with money to spend, because they can only use his credit card in the Hilton hotels. So a lot of these Hilton hotels overseas had fancy restaurants in them, fancy shops, and you could use your card, your credit card, in these shops. And again, we don't know exactly where they were from, like, a period of like 1 or 2 years prior to the assassination. We know he was working for carte blanche for Hilton, but we don't know where he was stationed.
Right. So big picture, these documents on James H. Martin, Marina's manager, basically show that his wife was working with the CIA. And so I guess what are the, and then also potentially that maybe he was following the Oswalds even in the Soviet Union. That's a little bit more of a stretch because it's not.
I think they were tasked more like when the Oswalds, because it wasn't like a sudden, I mean, it was kind of a sudden thing that the Oswalds got their exit visas, you know, relatively quickly as opposed to how long it should have taken them. But they could have easily been tasked when word got out that, hey, the Oswalds are coming back. We want you, you know, they could have said, okay, forget what you're doing right now. We want you to hop on this boat, follow them back to America. Let us know if you hear, see anything funny type of deal. But because they might have known that they were all from like the Dallas area, you know. Yeah,
but Matt, I don't think that they were in Russia, the Martins. No. What Rob is trying to say is like maybe they kind of hitched back on the way back.
They're in Europe.
Yeah, and this is not, you know, this is speculation, of course, but there is a James H. Martin on the manifest of the Mazdam. But one thing we're for sure about is that when he convinced the Secret Service to let Marina and the kids move in, and by the way, he was a married woman with... married woman, a married man with two infant kids, right? I think it might have been three. You're inviting the suspected wife of the assassin of the president with her two infant kids into a very crowded household. It doesn't really make sense. So,
and Wanda was not happy about it at all because this guy, James Martin, he sounds like a real sleazeball.
Join Solving JFK on Patreon for an extra weekly live episode starting Sunday, March 9th at 8 p.m. Eastern.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
We've got documents of things that are insane. I'll send them to you after the show and you can throw them up there if you want to. Of what happened when they were in Washington, as well as before that, earlier in January, there's reports of the Secret Service following James Herbert Martin on a trip to Denton. They went out there. He took Marina out to dinner, did not take Wanda, made her stay home with all these kids. Took Marina out to dinner to this restaurant. I mean, the agents were in the restaurant. We have their report. It says they were watching them the whole time. Then they followed them. The car started going to Denton, Texas. I don't know why. But it says it appears Marina's head went out of view several times during the trip. Maybe she was nodding off or something. But you know what I'm saying? But he would wrap her up and kiss her and dance with her in front of his wife and rope her in front of his wife.
And they did end up having sexual relations at the Willard Hotel during the War Commission testimony. That is approved by the documents. And then on their return to Dallas, Robert Oswald had heard of this and had convinced Marina to relieve James Herbert Martin of his role as business manager, and that actually resulted in a lawsuit, and there's a whole bunch of drama with that. But there's something more going on with James Herbert Martin and his wife, and we're still trying to, you know, we're still doing some more research on it, but it's fascinating for sure.
So definitely the CIA is interested in what's going on with Marina Oswald at post-assassination. The question is, are there any implications of, you know, on the case for that? Because you can kind of look at it either way. It's like, yeah, the CIA has this memo about here's 29 reasons why Marina's KGB. But would that be, that would be the FBI's jurisdiction within the United States to care about KGB folks though, right? So I'm just trying to think like of the devil's advocate argument of, you know, why it's not a spicy, exciting information and what the blog post looks like proving this wrong.
The FBI couldn't get close to her.
Right.
Because she didn't trust him. She wanted nothing, literally nothing to do with the FBI. That's who she was afraid of that could send her back. And they had made that threat. And so doing it through a cutout like James Herbert Martin didn't make it seem that serious, you know. And if his job was to get close to Marina, find out anything he can glean from her, whatever the case may be, whether it was, you know, I knew Oswald was going to do this, or, you know, get her drunk and maybe she'll talk, type of thing, you know, get intimate with her, maybe she'll talk, type of thing. And he did all that. And he did say later, I think, Joe, I don't know if it was for the Garrison case or the HSCA, but he did say that she did say some things to him that are kind of odd that you never would think. But he didn't say it like for the Warren Commission. He didn't tell them that. It was only later.
He definitely had a big influence on her, because if you think about it, you have to turn Marina into from a grieving widow into a kind of star witness in like 2 or 3 months.
Yeah.
And I think he was essential.
She had a lot of money coming in as well.
Yeah.
Hundreds
of thousands of dollars.
Right. So, and her testimony changed, you know, several times. Perhaps he could have been influential in that.
Definitely. Definitely.
Yeah. And no, I think he came up with the whole Nixon allegation, which was, I locked Lee in the bathroom. So he was going to go try to assassinate Nixon. But you can't, you know, lock someone from the outside. All that came from the time she was with James Herbert Martin. So definitely a very interesting character, and definitely not a household name, but someone we looked into. And, you know, 61 years later, we try to go and research the things that haven't been researched as much. if that makes sense.
Obviously, there's nothing on Operation Die Circuit at all anywhere that we could find. We've talked to some of the biggest names that would know, people like Bill Simpich, Larry Hancock, you know, all these very, you know, well versed, document based people. And there is nothing, and I mean nothing else on Operation Die Circuit. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the CIA used to have these funny acronyms or that they name things, their projects or operations type of thing. And DI was actually a prefix for Czechoslovakia, which doesn't really make any sense. And it only appears on one other document pertaining to Czechoslovakia under an operational pseudonym. But if you look at it in the context of an operation, and not really that, like you have MK Ultra, right? Or you know, something similar to that. And it could mean nothing. It could just be a cover name for whatever operations that they're doing. So, but there's nothing. I mean, we've literally not been able to find anything else on this Operation Die Circuit.
Hmm. Well, good work bringing the James H. Martin stuff to light. Let's pivot to your other big find, John Thomas Martin.
Yeah, this is a good one. Because many, many years ago, a researcher by the name of Paul Trejo, who was very interested in the General Edwin Walker theory of the assassination, which is another rabbit hole, really brought this film to the community's, really put in front of their eyes for the first time, because a lot of people had never heard of it before, let alone seen it. In the course of our research, it has a very specific history. Okay. So the film itself was taken, and it shows some certain things in it pre-assassination, which is odd. So you have in this piece of film, one piece of film, you have video footage of General Walker's house, okay, which Oswald allegedly shot at, allegedly in April of 1963. And then from there, it cuts to New Orleans, and you actually see Oswald on tape right after the fight with Carlos Brignier and those two other guys on the street. I mean, the leaflets on the ground, police there, the whole nine. And this is all pre-assassination. So that's kind of odd. You know, how could you have General Walker's house when they're talking about his assassination attempt, and showing the bullet hole in the window, and then it cuts to New Orleans to the supposed person that shot at General Walker.
And it's all the same film, same roll of film?
All the same film.
What is the, if I was some guy on a Facebook group, what would I yell at you to be mean about this? How could I criticize this? So, I mean, in other words, like, you feel pretty good about the, you know, the evidence trail of this particular.
Well, that in itself, you can only just say that's odd, right? It may be a coincidence. Crazy. It may not be. You know,
how could it be a coincidence though?
But what are the odds, you know, of that happening? They're astronomical, but do people win the lottery? Yeah. Okay.
It's the outside of Walker's house, and then it's also the gunshot hole, the hole, the bullet hole.
Yeah,
the
there is from inside of Walker's
house. Can I share it, Matt?
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm just going to do like a couple seconds of it. So essentially, you know, he starts on an airplane from Minnesota, and he's going to Dallas. I'm forwarding here. He's filming the clouds. This is a 17-year-old student from Creighton Military Academy in Minnesota.
It's a video film.
It's a video film.
Okay. Film. It's not just photos. Yeah. Okay.
This is the alleged bullet hole right here.
So right? it shows us that the video is coming from inside of the house.
Correct. Yes. Yeah. And you can see how dark it is, right? It looks like it's nighttime. Mm-hmm. This is the version on the current sixth floor website. There's a bunch of people outside the door, Cuban exiles or right wing people. Here we go, right there. So he then gets on the plane and goes to New Orleans. And this, he's at the zoo here. And I'm like forwarding 5 seconds every time here. He's at the, he's at the, what's that park name, Rob?
Not Lafayette Park. It's Jackson Park.
Yeah.
Jackson Square. Yeah.
Jackson Square. And then you see him cut to the Oswald fracas fight with Bringet on August 9th, 63. He's getting arrested. Those are the handbills on the ground. So how did this guy, the 17-year-old kid, and now he's back on the plane, how did this 17-year-old kid end up?
Well, hold on, Joe. Before we get there, let's explain the provenance of the film real quick. The film was sent to the FBI by the kid after the assassination in like December, around December 12th, I believe it was.
18th. Yeah.
18th, he sent the film to the FBI. They sent it to the New Orleans office. They determined there's no information of value here. They send it back to the kid. But you know what? It wasn't the same movie that he'd sent the FBI. There were things cut out of it. According to the kid that took the video, there was things that was different when he, what he got back was different. There was portions cut out of it. So fast forward to 1968. Harold Weisberg is at the University of Minnesota to give a talk on the assassination. And he meets a local, he meets up with a local researcher there. What was his name?
Gary Schoner.
Gary Schoner. And so in the course of Harold giving his talk there, this young student comes up and says, "Hey, I got this film I took a couple years ago, and it shows Oswald on the street." And one of the big things that Garrison and Weisberg were interested in is who was the person that was with Oswald handing out these handbills. Because according to the documents and according to the other film of the same incident that was taken and what they say, there was somebody else with Oswald as he's handing these handbills out. He's never arrested and he's cut out of the, both films. Because the other film that this other teenager shot from a different angle of this same fracas.
Doyle.
Yeah, the Doyle film. That portion is cut out as well. There's just Oswald. There's nobody with him. But they both say that there was somebody definitely with him handing out stuff, but this guy's never arrested or he's cut out of the films. So Weisberg gets the kid to make him and Gary Schoner and Garrison copies of this film. And he sends one to... Well, the kid said he sent one to Garrison on his own, but he doesn't know if he ever got it. So Weisberg gets another copy because when he's leaving Minnesota, he's going to New Orleans. So as he gets a copy, he's leaving and his bags get lost on the airplane. The movie gets stolen, right? Garrison's copy, but when he gets to New Orleans, he realized that, yeah, Garrison did have a copy there, but he never even looked at it yet, right? So, you know, they go through this hullabaloo of looking at the movie and talking to this kid some more, and they don't really find out much more than that. Fast forward to the HSCA, the late 1970s. They ask for his film, and he gives them a copy, or he gives him the film, and they make a copy of his film, and then they give him his film back. Now, they looked at the film at the HSCA, and they didn't find anything of interest either, allegedly. They supposedly kept a copy of his film. You know, they were copying all the films, and they were keeping copies for NARA, or at NARA. And it just kind of blows away and goes away. and you don't hear anything for 30 years, right? So I reached out to the curator at the sixth floor museum, and I was asking him about the film, like, you know, and he basically said the story is that when Gary Mack was still there and alive, that he was contacted by John T. Martin, and he said, "Hey, do you want my film?" And Gary Mack was like, "Yeah, sure." And he's like, "Okay, well, there's some conditions. Don't ever contact me again. Lose my information. I want nothing more to do with this film. And you know, please don't ever contact me and don't give out my information. Here's your film." And that was in 2007. I think it took 3 or 4 years for them to put it actually up on their website, which is, you know, the copy we just watched, and very dark. And even on the sixth floor website, it clearly states in this blurb, you know, if you click on to watch that movie, that this film, this piece of film had on it that it was created in 1977. So the HSCA kept this guy's original and gave him back a copy of his own film. And he never even knew it. And not that I blame him, because I think some people that shall remain nameless, and if you've watched our show before, we actually named them, but let's say photographic experts working for the HSCA back then. And I don't blame them. I probably would have done the same thing. We're copying these films and making personal copies, right? Just to sit on or show their buddies or keep for later, whatever the case may be, just curiosity. And I think somehow in the mix, you know, they kept his original copy, because now there is no copy at NARA. There is no copy of the John T. Martin film at NARA. It is missing. So
the version that we have is the version from the School Book Depository Museum?
Yes.
Okay, and then you said there's a version that's like lighter, that's brighter?
Well, I don't know where Martin Shackelford got his stills from. They're stills taken from the movie.
Got it, okay.
We tried to track down, we did talk to Gary Schoner, who was with Weisberg at the time, and he still has his copy somewhere. You know, it's like one of these things where it's in his attic or his garage, and, you know, he's 80-some years old and can't really look for it. Type of thing. And I contacted the curator of the Weisberg Archives, this guy, Ogilvy. And I was asking him, I was like, "Look, I know it's not online, but is it sitting on a dusty shelf somewhere, you know, in Frederick, Maryland, in the archives at the Hood College?" And he was like, "No, there's no physical films whatsoever in the Weisberg collection." I was like, "Okay." And he said what happened with a lot of that stuff was, when they were cleaning his house out, they moved everything basically to a carport. And a lot of it got damaged by rain, water, you know. And he said, so if there ever was any film, it's long gone. And it was sitting out there for anybody to take, he said, for weeks.
Wow.
Anybody could have gone through it and just picked through whatever they wanted.
So was... John T. Martin, is he ever on the record explaining what he was doing and why he has this film?
Well, I'll let Joe start there, because that's an interesting story as well.
Yeah, so Rob and I went through, I don't know how many rabbit holes, trying to actually identify this John T. Martin. And he had come up a couple times in different forums over the years, but no one really knew who he was. They thought it was actually John Timothy Martin, not John Martin. And I'm going to share something real here. We found his high school yearbook, senior, I don't know what you call it.
Picture. Kind of
picture, but also like description of what you're into. And
yearbook thing.
So he goes, plan to enter politics, classical music, chess. That's going to be important. Very conservative Republican, wants to abolish the Supreme Court, which was a far-right idea at the time.
Mm-hmm.
If it hadn't been for FDR, blah, blah, blah. So we dug really deep. And, you know, for a long time, it was assumed that this guy was served under General Walker in Germany. And he had taken this video for whatever reason. But we kind of figured out that, no, he didn't serve under General Walker. He was a 17-year-old kid at military school, as this picture says. And we found the University of Minnesota directory. And if you notice, on the far right-hand side in the yellow, it is John Thomas Martin with a 1752 Eagle Heart. On the bottom right is the FBI document from the Minutemen, which also has that same address, and it has chess music that matches up exactly with his high school senior bio. So we were able to say this guy didn't serve under General Walker. He just was a kid and might have served under him, but not in an official army capacity.
He just admired General Walker's virulent racism from afar.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yep.
And likely probably would have possibly even had a correspondence with him. You know, if he looked up to this guy as some kind of one of his heroes, it's very likely that he reached out to this guy and had some kind of correspondence with him and maybe even mentioned, hey, you know, my family's taking a vacation trip to Dallas. Would it be okay if I came to see you? Type of thing. I mean, because you don't just walk up to General Edwin Walker's house and knock on the door, you know, and expect to be like, hey, this is not creepy at all, but, you know.
Well, he might have respected the creepy. But, as we alluded to before, on the left is the sixth floor copy, right? Screenshot of the Walker mailbox. On the right is the Shackelford slides in the 90s. And you can see it is much clearer. It is not darkened. It is less cropped. You have another example of the Walker bullet hole, right? On the left-hand side, on the top here. You can't really tell on the right, right? And when you get to the fracas, you also have it cropped and clearly edited. So what is really going on here? And like Rob just, let me just stop sharing this. Like Rob alluded to earlier, our working theory is definitely the most plausible. And that is that John Martin, being a big fan of Walker and a Minuteman, at least in 64, corresponded with Walker and on his family trip to Dallas, stopped by his, quote, hero's house to say hi. And as we know now, Walker definitely wouldn't have turned away a young boy, especially someone who was willing to help the cause. But when John T. stops by, he records a video of Walker's mailbox, his house, the bullet hole, which we just showed, clearly inside of Walker's home. And we do not know why he went to New Orleans in time to get the Lee Harvey Oswald fracas fight with Brignais on tape. So did Walker tell John T. Martin to go to New Orleans and contact someone? Maybe a fellow right winger by the name of someone like Guy Bannister or someone of the sort. To film both Walker's house and the Oswald fracas on video in the same roll of film before the JFK assassination would be statistically improbable, bordering on impossible. Or is this just another coincidence in this extraordinary case? So we concluded the most likely scenario was John Martin asked Walker when he stopped by, what can I do to help, right? And was sent to New Orleans by Walker and told to contact someone, maybe Bannister, maybe another right-wing contact. We don't know.
Maybe Oswald himself.
Yeah.
Because here's another thing, Matt. So when you're talking about the street fight with Brignais, there is another incident of a street fight with anti-Castro Cubans. And this was in the book by Henry Hurt. There's an instance in there that tells, I believe, what bar was he in? It was Oris Pena's bar, the Habana bar. We know from that Lee Harvey Oswald wrote a letter to V.T. Lee of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee somewhere around August 1st. And in that letter to V.T. Lee, he describes a street fracas and, fighting with some anti-Castro Cubans. And I don't know if he wrote in there the cops came or something like that, but this was 8 days prior to the incident
that happened on Canal Street.
In the Henry Hurt book, there is another instance of something where Lee Harvey Oswald's mouthing off in the bar and he gets in a fight and it spills out onto the street. And I think he gets his ass beat pretty good, but there's nobody there to film it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So it's not caught on film. So maybe, and we know Lee Harvey Oswald wanted things on film. He wanted things on paper. He wanted things on TV. He wanted things on radio that he could point to and tell, the Cubans and the Russians, look at all I'm doing for you,
His legend, yeah.
Yeah, he's building his own legend to try to get to Cuba, allegedly.
Right. Wow. So John T. Martin never had like a deposition or anything like that?
No.
So we never... No. Because that'd be great to say, hey, man, what were you doing in New Orleans?
Well, trust me, bro. We tried to track this guy down.
We've been trying.
He is a freaking ghost.
So the implication then is, that kind of speaks to foreknowledge of something. I don't know what exactly. I'm trying to...
The far right.
Yeah.
And maybe Walker or...
The link between Walker and someone like Bannister would make a ton of sense. I mean, they're in the same.
We know they knew each other,
right?
I mean, Walker was in New Orleans with Bannister, like right before the assassination.
And then on the day of, like when the assassination happened, he was on a plane and he like told everybody on the plane, "I'm General Walker and I'm on this plane with you. I'm not killing presidents."
Yeah.
Yep, he spent the night in Shreveport, Louisiana, and the next morning, the Saturday, he was on the phone early with the German newspaper.
Right, yes, I remember.
To your point, does this mean that the far right possibly had knowledge of Oswald before the fracas on August 9th? And it's possible based on this video, because I don't think it's a coincidence. I think
Miltier into the mix too, and that's kind of a different geographic deal, but you know,
these guys knew each other. They used to go to these same conferences in Illinois, and there was a bunch of them in New Orleans, in Dallas. I mean, you got these right wingers meeting a lot at these different congresses or conferences that they would call them. Mm. And there was a big one that happened in New Orleans in October of 63. Wow. And we know that Walker, like I said, he was there on like the 20th and 21st, meeting with Guy Bannister, meeting with Leander Perez, who was a very wealthy DA of Black Mines Parish, which is kind of neighboring to Jefferson Parish. He was basically like the Jim Garrison of, the Black Mines Parish. Wow. And this guy was dirty as they come, rich as they come, corrupt as they come, a segregationist from, old school segregationist. There's actually, it's a funny video of him on firing line with William F. Buckley from the 60s. It's on YouTube if you want a good laugh for 50 minutes. But, these guys were, very, very far right in their ideals, very anti-segregationist, very anti-communist. And what Kennedy did, or what they viewed as his lack of action against Cuba and Russia in the early 60s, they viewed him as harmful to the country, enemy of the state. That's the way they thought.
Well, hey guys, I appreciate your time and awesome discoveries. I love that you're getting original research done. The closest I had to that was someone challenged me on Michael Payne actually being the first person to connect Oswald to Walker. And I've tried to find it in this in the Houston Post. I couldn't find it. It's not available. And some listener sent me he went down to the microfiche and found the original, you know, Houston Post copy. And indeed, it was Michael Payne the day after the assassination. But yeah, you guys doing awesome work. And I'd love to, once I get done with the season, I'll have a lot of questions. And I'd love like the I'll be maybe hopefully almost you know not caught up, but. There's, you know, the whole topics I have not done a deep dive on, and I'm just kind of doing the deep dive one thing at a time. So I can't wait until, I know enough to even be able to ask you guys the questions that I'll have about your thoughts on some things. So, anything you guys want to tell people? Your shows are live, Friday at 7 o'clock, right? Where can people watch?
Yeah. 7 PM Eastern at the Long Gun Podcast, on YouTube. You know, you can kind of search it and it will come up. We've been going live every week for 15 months now. It's not easy, but it's been fun. We have a lot of fun. We joke around, and I just want to thank you for having us on, and I really respect your objectivity, because I've listened to a bunch of your shows, and you've had a bunch of different people on, and you know, we need younger people that are bringing this, you know, like us. Two people on YouTube and other platforms that are just open, you know, think openly and don't, you know, just prescribe to one theory. And I really respect that about you. And I think you're going to come and hang with us on TLG at some point.
Yes.
Soon. We're looking forward to that.
Yeah, we got one in the calendar in March, I think.
Yeah. And looking forward to your season 3. So thank you again, Matt.
Appreciate it. Thanks, Joe. Thanks, Rob.
Thanks, Matt. It's been cool, man.
All right. Good stuff. Okay. And we'll be back March 5th with the first official episode of season 3 of Solving JFK Secret Service Part 1. Thanks, Vince Palomara. All right. Thanks, everybody.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.